House will come to order. The clerk, started to say, will the clerk call the roll, but as a matter of fact, we're advised that the voting machines are working this morning, so members can proceed to show their presence by voting. Take a special note to make sure that your light does indeed come on, so we want to make sure it's working. Has any member failed to show their presence? The clerk will take the roll.
36 present.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Speaker, no one is excused from the roll call today.
Please rise for the prayer this morning by Pastor John Tyndall of the Northern Light Church.
Anxiety sometimes leads to calmness. The ways that disorganization is sometimes the very necessary prelude to order and accomplishment in our houses. We give thanks and ask your direction. Amen.
Representative Rogers.
I move and ask unanimous consent that the prayer be spread on the journal.
Hearing no objection, the prayer will be spread on the journal. Will the clerk please certify the journal for the previous day?
As chief clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the first day with the following correction. On page 2, the last line, please add District 5, Betty Cato, District 16, Joseph Chuckwuck.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent that the journal for the first day be approved as corrected and certified by the chief clerk.
You've heard the motion. Is there objection? Hearing none, the journal for the first day will be approved as certified and corrected by the chief clerk. Before we get any further, there's one, Mr. Hilbert?
Yeah, well, you have the general reflect, my friend.
Will the clerk please reflect the presence of Mr. Hurlburt. Who else came in after the roll call? I think there's at least one other. Mr. Sudcliffe? Any others? Okay. They will be reflected as present. Before I get any further, I made one announcement yesterday during our performance closing session, but of course most members were not there. I should announce that under the provision of law, which is AS 2405120, the uniform rules of the previous legislature will serve as the temporary rules of the current legislature until permanent rules are adopted. In the area of announcements from the chair as well, we rang the bell this morning, but unfortunately I didn't realize that there's actually two different bell systems. The bell that you're used to hearing is this one. Well, I guess you can't hear it now with the door closed, but and that's what we'll use to call you when we're at a recess or something like that. But there's an additional bell that has more of a bell sound. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to hear it, but the additional bell that I'll ring in just a second is the bell that's actually hooked up to the Barron's location and to all of the other floors in the legislature here. And it sounds a lot like a telephone bell. I don't know if we can hear it in here right now or not, but we'll see. Yeah, it sounds like a fire bell, so I guess perhaps we'll get all fired up to come in to excuse that, please, but for the day's work. But in any case, that is the bell that will be pushed twice at the, 10 minutes before the session is to begin, and then that's the bell that will be pushed once as the session is, is imminent. I'm not sure under what circumstances we'll be using the old bell, because it's only hooked up to this floor, and if people are in their offices on other floors or in the Barron's building, they won't hear it. So be alert for that fire bell type sound, and that's the one that will actually call us to the session. We're down to introduction of guests. Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Pro Tem. In Gallery A, I'd like to introduce a guest from Anchorage, my business associate and right-hand person, Gene Von Dorman.
Are there further guests for introduction this morning? Mr. Adams.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem, in the gallery, I'd like to introduce my partner, my wife, Linda.
I think I'm already getting people mixed up. I think I called you Mr. Adams, but Mr. Baskin. It's all right. I'll mix at least everybody up at least once before the session's over, so it'll equal out. Further guests for introductions? Brings us down then to messages from the governor.
Mr. Speaker, I received from the governor's office on January 12th executive orders numbers 48, 49, 50, and 51. They aren't formally introduced, so they won't be printed today, but I did receive them.
Yeah, the provisional law, I believe, requires that executive orders be received on the first day of a session. So therefore, it is important for us to acknowledge receipt of those executive orders yesterday. They came in yesterday, even though they won't be acted upon until the House is organized, and those executive orders will be referred by the permanent speaker to committees, just like bills will be. But it is important that we acknowledge receipt of those executive orders. They, as I understand it, they were also received in the other body. Are there further messages?
Dear Mr. Speaker, if it is mutually convenient to the leadership of the House and Senate, I am prepared to give my State of the State message in a joint session at 2 p.m. Tuesday, January 13, 1981, and to give my budget message in a joint session at 2 p.m. Thursday, January 15, 1981. I would appreciate being advised by you and the President of the Senate if this is convenient. I look forward to working with you. Best wishes for a productive 1981 session. Signed sincerely, J.S. Hammond, Governor of Alaska. I have no further messages from the governor, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, for the information of the body, we have extended an invitation to the Senate to meet with us at 2 o'clock this afternoon to hear the State of the State message by the governor. Representative Smith will move later on this morning that we stand in recess until 1:45, but I'll just announce at this time and ask that all the members do please be prompt in arriving at about 1:45, because I presume this will be, as usual, a statewide broadcast that will start promptly at 2 o'clock, television cameras, and it's very distracting if we're trying to start a joint session, people are just then arriving, so we would ask members to be in their seats at 1:45 or 1:50 at the latest, but that particular motion will be made a little bit later on. Messages from the Senate?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Communications?
There's a communication from Representative Jim Duncan, Chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, enclosing a status report on Alaska State Legislature et al. Versus Hammond et al. The attachments mentioned in the report are not enclosed due to their considerable volume. The attachments are available from the Legislative Finance Division, Room 502, Capitol Building. I have no further communications, Mr. Speaker.
I see we have a delegation here from the Senate. We're glad to see Senator Strzelczewski and Kelly. Welcome to the House chambers. Thank you very much for coming down to see us, and please extend our thanks to your colleagues in the Senate. Tell them that we hope to be able to send a similar delegation to your end of the hall in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much. Since we have not the authority to refer bills, citations, resolutions, or act on any calendar, we're down to unfinished business, which is at the state we were in yesterday. Is there any other business to come before the body before we place a recess motion?
Mr. Speaker?
Mr. Byrne?
I'd like to make an astounding announcement.
The floor recognizes the astounding Mr. Burns.
The astounding announcement is that I was totally astonished to come here and find this tremendous amount of these goodies here on my desk today. And I don't know where they came from for sure, but the word is out that the Speaker Pro Tem, feeling guilty because he stole so much of my candy last year, that he left this for me this year.
That rumor, Mr. Burns, like an amazing number of other Burns, is accurate. Having fed at the trough next to your desk there for so long, I thought the least I could do is start out the year slightly paying back last year's goodies. But Mr. Hayes?
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, before the motion for recess, I'd like to announce that the House Republicans will meet in caucus at 11 a.m. at the in the same room that we met yesterday.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Mr. Speaker, if there are no other announcements, I ask unanimous consent that the House stand in recess until 1:45 p.m.
You've heard the motion. Is there objection? Hearing none, the House is in recess to 1:45.
Holder, perception of the state of the state lies in one's mind, heart, or pocketbook. During the year of 1980, the fabric of Alaska made up a coat of many colors. These ran from red to black. Regardless of how that coat fit one's particular circumstances, all agree it provided more warmth to some than others. Statistically, Alaska fared well compared to other states. For example, while unemployment zoomed elsewhere, employment rose another 4,644 jobs the first 9 months of 1980. Despite an attendant population increase of 6,000 people, Alaska for the first time fell from the top 10 states in unemployment. In August, our 7.8% unemployment rate was almost the national average. Much job growth was achieved through state aid to business, in which studies show Alaska led the nation. Low-interest business loans jumped from $7.5 million in 1975 to over $325 million. State-subsidized housing loans, some less than half of market rate of interest, further force-fed Alaska's economy and promoted growth. This was reflected in the trebling of Alaska's building permits in the third quarter of 1980 over the same period in 1979. Part of the more than $500 million worth of 1980-funded capital projects also helped bolster the economy. Bids let in 1980 increased 20% over 1979. Unfortunately, $160 million in expeditable projects became pawns of House Bill 60, which did not pass until May 31st. Had they passed 3 months earlier, as I strongly urged, most would have been on the street last summer, helping a hard-pressed construction industry which leans increasingly upon state spending. In 1980, personal income rose a whopping 16% and outstripped inflation. Statistics, of course, do not tell the story as well as do individuals. For example, most Anchorage businessmen I've questioned recently say business was pretty good. Some say 1980 was the best year ever. Many seem almost embarrassed to make such confession public and thus give the lie to zero growth horror stories perpetrated by influential interests with whom they do business or associate. 1980 also saw increased Alaskan mining. Dr. Warren Meend of the U.S. Geological Survey estimates gold production more than quadrupled from 13,500 ounces in 1978 to 65,000 in 1980, and that roughly 5,000 people were engaged. Though much under the 1906 million ounces plus production, the almost $40 million value of 1980 gold exceeds a previous high of $26 million set in 1940. 600,000 tourists visited Alaska. This 15% increase over 1979 was unequaled in the U.S. marketplace and demonstrates sustained economic growth. Similarly, 1980, from a fishery standpoint, was a bright year for the fish. To fishermen, however, the glow of the largest salmon pack since 1932 dims in light of drastically reduced fish prices. Though since 1975, the pack has increased each year, 1980 was dull for those believing inflation would boost not only costs, but earnings. Nonetheless, fishery production was valued at $1.2 billion, providing income untold for almost 50,000. Incidentally, bottom fish landings in Alaska increased almost sixfold in 1980. Investments made in agriculture showed continued promise. Alaska now imports nearly 95% of that consumed, yet we have nearly 20 million arable acres. That's more potential cropland than producing cropland in Washington, Wyoming, Montana, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and half of Nebraska combined. 18 months ago, Delta Agricultural Project lands were largely scrub timber over permafrost. Accomplishments to date are remarkable. Some 30,000 acres have been cleared, 13,000 acres are under production. Barley yield is almost twice the national average. Several Asian markets assert they will purchase all we can produce because of its exceptional quality. Some farmers may profit this first year, an almost unprecedented circumstance. An expanding red meat industry related to local availability of feed indicates a glowing future. Absent private risk capital, the state must take an active role in agriculture for anything to happen. Therefore, I support both Delta 2 and the Point McKenzie project, but am concerned that ultimately the state's investment is a good business venture for all Alaskans. Alaska now has a comparatively attractive business climate when it comes to items over which government has control. I believe we're the only state with no statewide sales, property, or income tax. We've eliminated the business inventory tax and through revenue sharing provide municipalities which funds business otherwise would have to pay in local taxes. Massive infusion of state money has padded Alaska's economy against the national economic downturn. However, some question the long-term effect of this. After all, government subsidy of private industry is just another form of government growth. Economic activity which can generate enough new income to offset costs to state services provided each employee and family member is the test of healthy economic growth. The possibility of meeting that test diminished greatly with personal income tax repeal. Corporate income tax reduction would make such impossible unless tax revenues lost are supplanted with other recurrent income rather than capital wealth, or there is a comparable reduction in consumption of capital for state spending. Otherwise, with neither taxes nor sufficient royalties to do so imposed on any resource except oil, their development will likely be at a financial loss to the people of the state. Like other states, revenue from oil pays severance and service and infrastructure costs associated with all other development. Because of this, new development and attendant new jobs could cost Alaskans collectively far more from their oil wealth than it returns to them in other revenues. Of course, some selective interests which benefit from the new development could care less and will attack those who question the wisdom of subsidized growth, charging the questioner with advocating zero growth or some such nonsense. Many individuals benefit now from our surplus wealth at hidden costs to all other Alaskans. I'd like to show you how enormously inequitable some of these distributions are compared to other methods. Take low-interest loans, for example. When the state loans money, which belongs to all Alaskans, to some Alaskans at interest rates less than that which the money could be earning, loan recipients get a subsidy, or dividend, if you will, from the public's money. This year, just for housing loans, that subsidy will amount to at least $225 million. These subsidies will go to less than 5% of our people, and incidentally are almost twice the amount to be distributed in the Permanent Fund Dividend Program, which of course would go to all Alaskans, A to Z. It's ironic that this far more equitable distribution of benefits is hung up in court, while we expand unchallenged a more selective and costly program. Business loan subsidies are even more dramatic and inequitable. Losing the public earnings on their money by subsidizing loans for a commanding public purpose may be appropriate. My concern is for equity and the best collective benefit for each dollar subsidy. And I'm not sure we're achieving that when the recipient of, say, a $300,000 loan at a 9.5% interest rate receives a first-year dividend of more than $30,000 tax-free from money which could be earning up to 20% for all Alaskans, as it is now on our other investments. It would be interesting to put to a vote whether most Alaskans would prefer to continue such loans or use that, say, $225 million of current subsidy to perhaps increase permanent fund dividends threefold. There are many other programs which can or do convey dividends to select groups. Take, for example, royalty oil sales at less than market rate. Who benefits primarily? the processors, a few consumers who might get gas a penny or two less per gallon, the international airlines which refuel in Alaska, and possibly a handful of prospective employees. However, an even greater problem with cut-rate royalty oil sales, as well as subsidized loans and tax reliefs, is that they tend to increase consumption of oil wealth, and that's like eating one's seed potatoes. It concerns greatly those who, like myself, think we should plan for the day when we may run out of oil. A far more healthy and equitable means of injecting public money into the economy is the permanence on dividend concept. It's more equitable because all Alaskans share. It is healthier because, unlike subsidies which consume capital, dividends come from interest earned on investments of that capital and not from the wealth itself. Moreover, dividends would stimulate business far more directly, since rather than filtering the people's oil wealth through government or industry before it got to the marketplace, a portion would go into the pockets of all Alaskans to be spent as they saw fit. Now big government or big business makes those decisions for them. Dividends would inject about $130 million into the economy the first year alone. This exceeds the amount injected where we'd create $6,000, $20,000 a year jobs. However, unlike the creation of such jobs through subsidizing industry, there would be no increased spending required to provide services for 6,000 or more new job seekers and their families. Additionally, dividends would annually pump a far greater percentage directly into the Alaskan economy than to tax relief, since almost 50% of tax relief benefits went to non-Alaskans or to the IRS. Accordingly, my highest priority remains a viable permanent fund dividend program. However, neither amendments to the program nor alternative cash dispersals, such as I'll propose, can be allowed to jeopardize our legal case. Implementation of D2 poses both a challenge and the chance to solve problems associated with long overdue land conveyance and federal-state relations. Although few Alaskans like the bill, most agree it better accommodates the state's 7 consensus points than did executive withdrawals. Moreover, yesterday the state was committed to following the legislative marching orders, which urged us to, quote, work for a bill this year, unquote, not next year, no bill at all, this year, which better accommodated such objectives. The state is now committed to working with our congressional delegation and through the Land Use Council to influence federal agency action and coordinate state agency implementation in hope of wiser management. Consistent with this goal at the state level, I will propose changes in our land disposal program. 3 years ago, most protests came because disposal was deemed insufficient. Today, greatest protest comes because we're compelled to dispose of lands which local people view as inappropriate or more appropriate for some other public purpose. Another challenge is to improve our federal-state relationships by increasing its state's ability to solve its own problems. The Statehood Commission provides a forum for discussion of such matters. Although I did not first support the commission, I can understand support generated by frustration with our federal landlord and proposals by outside politicians that Alaska's newfound wealth be shared with other states before basic needs long since met in their respective states have been met up here. The commission can play a constructive role if its objective is not to shatter but shore up a union of fully federated states. Other governors see the need for such mechanisms. At a recent conference, there was much support for what they termed the new federalism. Each state was asked to hold a convocation to assess federal-state relationships and recommend means which could resurrect 50 sovereign federated states. And our review commission should do exactly that. As one means of enhancing state sovereignty, governors propose that federal revenue sharing should be non-categorical, permitting states to direct dollars where needs are greatest. I believe local governments should have the same privilege. Accordingly, I hope to fund fully non-categorical municipal assistance and expand revenue sharing. This will increase about sixfold the funds which can be spent as determined locally for tax reduction, capital improvements, or other local programs. Legislators distressed by charges of pork barreling and wild spending should be supported. Previously, a legislator's success too often depended on less on statesmanship and more on the ability to bring home more than one's fair share. In the process, some are either shortchanged or budgets skyrocket, as a new school here is traded for a convention center there. With so-called surplus oil wealth, appetites have grown insatiably, and no matter how big the pie, it's evident it can all be consumed. unless we provide alternatives which more equitably slice that pie and permit the public to determine content. Municipalities should welcome the changes I propose. Now, they frequently have thrust upon them capital projects which require local tax increases for operation and maintenance. Constraint on state budget growth would also more easily be exercised. With increased discretion, local officials would be held responsible for prioritizing needs and wants from funds available. When we're compelled to make those decisions for them, state budget size too often is determined by adding up the wants. The major need consider is what we need to end the session. Before leaving office, I'm determined to provide more equitable financial support to Alaskan school districts. While past changes in the school foundation program helped, some inequities remain. For example, people within municipalities pay property taxes for basic school construction. Those living elsewhere do not. Therefore, I propose the state assume not only 100% of current debt service for past municipal school construction, but 100% of future construction which meets the same criteria as imposed on REAAs. While this should permit local tax reduction, municipalities should retain the right to add enrichments through local taxes. Municipal school construction obligations now deter many areas from forming local governments. Removal of this penalty, accompanied with prospects of expanded municipal assistance, should prove attractive to those wishing to acquire local self-determination. Another challenge for the 80s is the resolution of the capital move, now stalemated by two conflicting public votes. Though 46,659 voted to move the capital, 69,414 later asked that before the capital move commenced, they be allowed to vote on the bondable costs, which were then voted down. Resolve this stalemate requires that these two conflicting votes be reconciled. Some argue that no longer do most want to move the capital to Willow South. They attribute this in part to growing awareness of prospective business losses incurred in Anchorage, as well as Juneau, should the capital move. They assert that if only 1,500 of the more than 4,000 Anchorage state employees move, could mean loss of $40 million salary dollars, the vacating of more than 1,000 homes, lost shared revenues attending population reduction of about 4,000 people, plus loss of millions of dollars spent by those who now fly into Anchorage, renting cars, hotel rooms, and buying meals while on government business. Others disagree. They urge legislators to repeal the Frank Initiative and provide direct funding for the move. Now, I don't presume to know which view now prevails. However, indisputably, voters clearly stated they wish to vote on the bondable costs of moving. And I believe most Alaskans still wish to vote on the cost of the move, whether funded by bonds or direct appropriation. Should that wish be denied, this issue will continue to fester and divide us. Healing can start only if the people are allowed to vote on the true costs of a specific, realistic move based on facts, not pressure generated by those who would stand to gain personally by either the move or the status quo. This requires providing a commission with funding and a broadened mandate to determine facts. After doing so, this question should be placed upon the ballot. Shall X dollars be spent to accommodate these specific elements of state government in Willow South? Then listed should be the number and or class of employees, for example, central versus regional, to be moved from both Anchorage and Fairbanks, or from Juneau. Absent specifics as to those state employees who would be relocated, it is impossible to plan for the future of not only Willow South, but also Anchorage and Juneau. For example, we should consolidate those state functions now in Anchorage, but why try if they're to move to Willow South? On the other hand, if we're not going to move them or their counterparts from Juneau, voters should be aware. Past votes have been on the presumption that the full-fledged rather than token capital move was to occur. To lay the issue to rest one way or the other, the ballot should stipulate that if most voters support funding a specific move, we must get on with it. However, if rejected, all prior initiatives would be repealed. Meanwhile, I must assume from their vote to move a functional capital to Willow South that most Alaskans still wish to do so. However, I'm equally compelled to assume by their later vote for the Frank Initiative and against $900 million in bondable costs that the majority of Alaskans still wish to vote on funding. And I'm determined they be so permitted. Just as some argue that bondable costs to accomplish a capital move as outlined in the Frank Initiative were excessive, efforts to promote a non-specific token capital move which is less than functional and hope that subsequent pressures will prompt expansion and funding not requiring approval by the people will be viewed with a jaundiced eye. This issue remains unresolved, is not only divisive but in some respects ludicrous. The only way it can be resolved to the satisfaction of most is by a vote designed to undo the current stalemate. Yet pro-movers resist such, asserting we voted to move it, why vote again? While anti-movers say we turned down the costs, why vote again? Both seem fearful they'll lose next time. Rather than acknowledge those fears and start an initiative designed to resolve them, many prefer to blame someone else. Personally, I get a bit tired of those complaining because I'll not break the law and move the Capitol. To those who wonder why I have not pitched my tent in Willow South, there's one simple answer. You made that illegal when you passed a law which reads, and I quote, state money may be expended to relocate physically the present functions of state government, including the governor, only after the majority of those voting in the statewide election have approved the bond issue, unquote. By its rejection, you denied me the right to pitch that tent. And I'm sure that ignorance of the law, rather than politics or stupidity, prompts some to keep demanding that I break it. The public, not the legislature, voted to move the Capitol. The public, not the legislature, voted against moving it until they had approved the bondable costs. Therefore, the legislature should no more amend the Frank Initiative in such a way as to bypass public desire to vote on move costs than they should amend the move initiative to require the Capitol to move, say, to Anchorage or not at all. Once issues have been addressed by conflicting public initiatives, leadership has been taken from elected officials, save for the obligation of showing the public means of resolving stalemates. Also stalemated are the permanent fund dividends. Although I believe the U.S. Supreme Court will rule favorably, as did our state Supreme Court, many counted on receiving dividends. Therefore, as a stopgap to help meet this expectation, I'm submitting legislation which would grant each Alaskan a share of the premium paid recently for their royalty oil. I'm aware of a multitude of other proposals which would distribute portions of our oil wealth. My prime concerns, once again, are equity and appropriate public purpose. One most appropriate public purpose I'm exploring is the provision of better health care to all Alaskans. Currently, the state provides this through health insurance for state employees and their families at no cost to the employee. An argument can be made that if health insurance is provided at no cost to some by the state, equity demands that all are so provided. Should revenues permit and you wish to provide another means of sharing them with Alaskans, I hope you give this concept priority consideration. The study commenced last year is developing a menu of such suggestions. Meanwhile, I propose the state's current catastrophic illness program be redesigned and funded to cover more Alaskans. As another means of privatizing and more equitably sharing oil wealth, I will reintroduce the portfolio of Alaskan Citizen Enterprises, or PACE program. While permanent fund dividends would provide shares of earnings from our oil wealth, PACE would grant all Alaskans some share of the wealth itself in a manner avoiding most AGSOC problems. Specifically, I'll propose a royalty trust granting each resident equal shares of some of our royalty oil, dependent upon how invested, a refinery, petrochemical plant, or simply sold at the best price. Citizens receive commensurate dividends. Nothing could do more to create public demand that their resources be developed prudently so that no selective interests prosper at inordinate cost to the public. The last challenge I wish to discuss is unquestionably the most difficult and important: how we manage our surplus oil wealth during the 1980s to best assure the state's long-term economic health. Should we act imprudently, fates, if not the federal government, may well remove this option. I believe prudent wealth management demands we do four things: save some, invest some, spend some, and share some. The best mechanism for saving is the permanent fund. Accordingly, I'll propose a large contribution. While I'd hoped Alaskans by now would have received dividends bolstering support for such contributions, as opposed to simply more government spending, uncommon sense, if not politics, requires we place as much as possible of our current surplus into the fund where it will generate income which can help pay for programs which are now consuming capital. I also propose investing substantially in resource development, which will be here long after cost-effective non-renewable resource wealth extraction may conclude. These include investments in renewable energy resources, food production, and, of course, education of our prime resource, our people. As far as spending is concerned, existing and prospective programs will amply provide for that. And finally, we should share some wealth with all Alaskans to help them meet Alaska's exceptionally high cost of living. Again, repeal of the income tax did this only partially. Benefits went just to taxpayers. Repeal also, unfortunately, served to encourage excessive spending by reducing taxpayer resistance, since the public no longer perceived themselves required to pay directly a thing for services. Of course, they pay indirectly. We politicians do it for them by spending their capital wealth. Since few recognize that wealth is partially their own, they neither feel the pinch nor pass that pinch on to elected public officials. Talk about political nirvana. We can give the public every program they may want without seeming to charge a cent. We should change that while we can. The public should know hidden costs and alternatives. Only then can they decide what's in their best interest. Currently, there are many ways in which we share the public's wealth. However, most benefits select groups, not the general public. Only the permanent fund dividend provides every Alaskan with a share. While I prefer this method of sharing, the public should make that choice. I'd like to give that to them by putting before the voters a list of existing proposed selective subsidies or programs and letting them choose whether their share should be so spent or used to increase their dividend checks. Now, some term dividends free money, something for nothing. I don't at all. With the opportunity afforded, should go the obligation as well to spend your dividends for your true needs. Accordingly, accompanying dividend payment should be a comparable reduction in state spending for programs which far exceed those envisioned by our founding fathers as appropriate functions of government. We should let the people buy these services from the private sector with their dividends, should they wish to do so. I believe most would prefer this. Of course, those who did not should have the option of relinquishing their dividends and electing they go instead into their favorite government program. In the 1980s, Alaska will be faced with unique challenges bringing both opportunity and danger. Our current substantial wealth broadens that opportunity, but also deepens that danger. While statistically, Alaska's economy improved, unlike most other states, it can be argued that Alaska has the most unhealthy economy of all. Elimination of income taxes, gross receipt taxes, reduction of school taxes, massive subsidized low-interest loans, increased revenue sharing, and injections of hundreds of millions of state dollars brought a flush to the cheeks of the private sector. However, make no mistake, it is simply the flush of feverish government spending, not the healthy glow of solid, unsubsidized economic growth which can pay its own way. Before income tax repeal, oil paid 73% of government costs. It now pays over 90%. Some would increase this to 100% by eliminating all taxes save those on oil. If income from normal tax sources is further reduced, prudence demands that there first be either a commensurate reduction of government spending or another source of recurrent income to supplant tax dollars lost. Politics, of course, dictates precisely the opposite. Thus, imprudently, we were stampeded in the income tax repeal before either condition was first met. In view of this, it's imperative that a reasonable constitutional spending limitation be imposed if we hope to manage our wealth prudently. In my budget message, I will outline one proposal. At a recent conference, many governors described drastic actions they were taking to assure that their respective ships of state did not founder in red ink. They cited how they were furling sail and battening hatches on scores of programs which, if continued, would compel them to live above their means. Alaska's current revenue surplus and income tax repeal were viewed with envy. Yet many concluded that though Alaska's ship of state, by contrast to their own, may be coursing smartly into the wind, beneath the paint and the polish lies lots of dry rot. Almost all asked, what happens when you run out of oil? A good question scoffed at by many Alaskans who should know better. But we are now floating high on a tide of black oil rather than bumping bottom in a pool of red ink. Rudderless floating is fraught with far greater hazard. Not only is one less likely to sail knowingly into deeper red ink, but the higher the tide, the farther up on the beach one can be stranded when that tide runs out. Alaskans should not delude themselves into thinking everything ship-shape simply because we have funds in excess of today's needs. If we fail to set our course carefully or are blown off it by the winds of politics, we're liable to swamp in a flood tide of tomorrow's wants. However, if we work together, we can weather the current national economic decline while providing for both needs and many wants. My budget message, I'll present a plan which draws heavily on past legislative expressions for particulars. Should you wish to change some particulars, that, of course, is your privilege. My privilege, in turn, however, is, of course, to exercise those powers of command which can help dissuade those who would alter our basic course. Because so many of you have expressed kindred concerns, I'm looking forward to a productive session which charts horizons far beyond those of next year's election. Thank you.
Come back to order. Before we proceed to announcements, I'll acknowledge that Mr. Carney is on the floor and is here and is present. And I believe there are two or three announcements to be made before we stand in adjournment till tomorrow. Mr. Hayes, did you have announcements you wanted to make?
The House Republicans will caucus at 3 o'clock in the Butrovich Room.
Are there further announcements? Mr. Randolph?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I refrained yesterday, but I think it's appropriate this time that I call a Libertarian House caucus this time at 3 o'clock also.
I'll... Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Senator Fahrenkamp asked me to announce to the body that at 1:30 tomorrow afternoon in the Belts Room will be an overview on mining. All members are welcome. There's no specific legislation. They'll just have people brought in to talk about the subject and take a look at what has been done and what needs to be done. The Democrats will be caucusing on adjournment. And with that, I will move and ask unanimous consent that the House stand in adjournment until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay, before placing the announcement, I'll just introduce a quick guest, the former Lieutenant Governor of the State of Alaska and outstanding citizen still, Red Boucher. One more quick announcement before I also place the motion. On the continuing saga of the bells and alarm system, it now turns out that the bell that we usually brings us in rings only in the lounge. It doesn't. So if you're in the lounge and hear both the alarm bell, or I mean if you're in the halls and hear both the alarm bell and then a second later the normal bell that we've been listening, it's just because we have to push them both. But whenever you hear two, that means you've got 10 minutes, regardless of the bell you're hearing. When you hear one, that means we're ready to commence. Hurry in because you're late. And you may hear a blend of the two, I'm not sure. We'll try to get this bell system coordinated. If there's nothing further to come before the body, is there objection to the motion to adjourn? Hearing none, the body stands adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.